the discussion section after this class.
Yeah, gosh, I didn't know that. You're at 11 o'clock on Thursday.
11 o'clock Thursday?
I tell you what, today, just sit anywhere you want to, and hand it into ATA and tell them I'm not sure this is the right one, and we'll find you. Oh, Miguel, yes.
I know you yesterday. You mentioned that there would be more handouts.
Yeah. Are there not other handouts at the back of the room?
I saw one.
Okay, you need to find
I have for today. From last week, yeah, I printed out number 2. I didn't get any copies. I don't have a physical copy of the Harvard laptop one. Which ones do you need?
I was thinking
you weren't here? Let's go.
I enrolled in this class after the first class.
You need to
get your other handouts or 5 handouts that were handed out on the last class period. They're going to get up on the website eventually. You don't have to worry about it. You can just get them off the website later. But I think that will be late, so they're not up to right now.
Do you have your own website, or is it on campus?
It'll be on campus, and it'll be on LarrySpeck.com.
Okay, thank you.
And actually, you can go to LarrySpeck.com, and there are old versions of it, and you can see the old version.
Okay.
Not
I'm Sam.
How are you?
Crazy email.
I'll
be in the front. I did. It was fun.
Damn, I told you 3 times. I said TA session.
I even wrote it down on the form. I don't
know. Really. But the encouraging thing about that was how helpful people were.
I know. Yeah, I was like, the teacher came to rescue, and then there's a guy there too, and we talked about it.
Yes.
Faith in humanity.
Yeah, that's good. Faith in UT.
Yeah.
Hey.
I actually work at the Skyspace on campus, and I get people from this class saying that, like, y'all talk about it.
Right? Uh-huh.
Yeah, like, all the time. So I just want to say thank you.
Good. Actually, not so much in this class, but my other class, I definitely talked about this class.
Okay, well, thank you for, like,
Good. I love it. I love that class.
Hi. I know your policy on, like, electronics is right, but what about handwritten notes?
I'm okay with that. Okay. I will say I'm a little hesitant.
Okay.
In that you will be distracted by the possibility of doing other things with that handheld device. Will you swear to me?
I will swear
not
to you.
Do that?
I actually don't do that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Then I'm okay with that.
All right. Thank you.
Oh, wait a second. So you do need to, if it's a lighted device,
turn down the brightness. All right. Thank you.
Okay. For those of you coming in, this is the drill. You see on the top left-hand corner there, unique numbers 545, 570. That's right down here in this corner of the room. Unique numbers 565, 580. That's the next segment up here. Unique numbers 555, 560. That's at the back of the room on this side. And the same way on the other side. Now, if today you can't remember your unique number or you're standing there holding up people in the aisle trying to locate your unique number on your iPhone, forget it. Just sit somewhere and just hand in your Twitter card to some TA. So it's not all that critical today. We do need to kind of facilitate moving in and getting people in the seat and out of the lobby. So try to sit in your area today, but if that didn't work out, it's not the end of the world. And again, this same chart will be up next time. Absolutely be sure next time you walk in, you know what your unique number is, you know where to sit. Also, any of you who missed handouts from the last class, this is Elia, one of the TAs. Elia has handouts that you might have missed from the last class. So get them from him.
Okay.
Okay, just to remind you again, if you could pull into the center, if there's a vacant seat by you, if you could move to the center so that all the vacant seats are on the aisle and not in the middle of the row, that would be great. Okay, shall we begin? So just to remind you of a few logistical things we covered last time. For one thing, when you come in, you should try to sit geographically in the area where your unique number places you. So you should look out. That'll be up next time. Be sure you get in that area. Quiet. Okay, that worked. And just to see, I don't know if all the TAs are here, but Anna, are you here? She may be in the back. Yeah, Anna's in the back there. Those of you who are in Anna's section up here, she's your TA. The next group is Heidi. Heidi's right there. She'll be your TA. The next section is Sean. Sean's standing up back there. He'll be your TA for that group back there. So this is so you know who to give your Twitter card to. You guys give it to Anna in the middle. You give it to Heidi. Raise your hand again, Heidi. In the back, you give it to Sean. He's got his hand up there. In the front here, you'll be giving your Twitter card to Juan. Is that right? No, sorry, to Eli. Eli's in the back there. He'll be up here later. Elijah in the middle, right there. And Juan in the back, right there. So everybody, when it's time to give in your Twitter card, you need to find your TA and give it to them. So if you have any handouts you're missing, Elijah, raise your hand again, Elijah. He's the TA in charge of handouts. And he has extras from last time. If you missed getting one, get them from Elia after class. They'll be out in the back.
I'm going to set them out of class and just go back to the music
stand. And I apologize for them not yet being up on the website. My computer is being switched out, and they ran into a big problem. And for 24 hours, I have not had access to my files, which is like death. But the guy was in there all morning, this morning. He tells me by the time I get back after class, he'll have it done. And then they will be up on LarrySpec.com shortly after that. But right now, paper version is the most reliable thing to get. Okay, I think that's kind of the logistical issues. So, can we switch, Eli, to the regular slideshow, away from the chart and to the slideshow? Okay, Anna's doing that. So, we're going to start today with a definition of architecture. It is not the definition you'll find in a dictionary, but it is a working definition we're going to be using for the semester in this class. Yeah, and you need to take it down in your notes. That's a good thing. So this is our definition of architecture. Architecture is the physical embodiment of who we are as individuals and who we are collectively as a culture. Architecture is the physical embodiment of who we are as individuals and who we are collectively as a culture. Now, let me give you some examples of this. So let's say that UT had this incredibly liberal policy about their dormitories, and they would allow you, when you moved in, to do anything you wanted to your room, and you could redesign it to suit just what you wanted. And so let's say you move into Jester, and you move into one of those little prison cell rooms, and you paint everything black. Wall, ceiling, everything jet black. And you get a blackout shade for that little prison-sized window, and you black it out completely, and you get this badass zebra skin rug that you put on the floor, black and white, and you get this matching zebra print bedspread that you put on your bed. And you get one of those really cool disco lights from the 70s with all the little mirrors on it. And you get a laser light that points to it, and it sparkles and shines and twists around the room. And you get two huge Bose speakers, and you set up this amazing sound system. And you play your music. You have a couple of posters, rock posters on the wall. You had this den of iniquity and this intense environment. So say then I walk into Jester, I walk down the hall, I knock on your door, you open it up, I go into your room, I get a certain impression of who you are. That architecture becomes a physical embodiment of who you are. And consciously or unconsciously, intentionally or unintentionally, I'm going to get an impression of who you are by that physical environment that you've designed and chosen to live in. Now, by contrast, imagine that you move into exactly that same room and you paint all the walls and ceiling Pepto-Bismol pink, bright, pretty pink, and you put curtains on the on that little window, lace curtains, white lace curtains. And you get a matching bedspread that's also white lace and matches the curtains perfectly. And you put up a little poster board on the wall, and you has your corsage from the prom, and it has pictures of you and your friends in high school doing all the things you did in high school. And you have all of your stuffed animals from your entire childhood, and they're all over the bed and in the corners of the room. And let's say I knock on your door and I open the door and I walk in. I likewise get an impression of who you are as an individual. Whether I intend to, whether I don't intend to, whether I'm conscious of it or I'm not conscious of it, I read into that physical environment and your inhabitation of it, I read into it some messages about who you are. Architecture is a physical embodiment of who we are as individuals. Even if you don't do a damn thing to that Jester room and you just inhabit it exactly as it was given to you, that also would say something about who you are. Architecture is a physical embodiment of who we are as individuals. Now, imagine at another scale. So let's say you graduate from UT, and let's say you graduated in education. You're going to be an elementary school teacher. And you get a job out in Lockhart, small town about 30 miles southwest of here. And you, you know, rents are pretty cheap in Lockhart. You're able to actually afford, you know, a little bungalow house on a little tree-lined street. And this bungalow house has some big pecan trees in the yard, and it's got a little porch on the front. And it's got enough space. You got a little garden where you can raise your fruits and vegetables. And you're totally into this. You can walk to the elementary school, so you do that. You can walk to the church you go to. There's a little grocery store not far away. You walk down to the grocery store. You find yourself a lot of times just sitting out on that front porch. There's a little porch swing. You do your email out there. Your neighbors walk by on the sidewalk. They say hello. They're walking their dog or something, and pet the little puppy, and get to know your neighbors a little bit that way. And you see the same people over and over, the same people at church, and you have their kids in school. And every morning you wake up, you hear the birds singing in the trees. If you live in that physical environment for 10 years, it will shape who you are. You will become a certain kind of person by the people you see and the interactions you have, and it will shape who you are. Now, by contrast, let's say you graduated from UT and instead you moved to New York City and you decided to live in this really cool neighborhood, Chelsea, sort of between Midtown and Downtown. It used to be an old meatpacking district. Now it's a really cool art scene kind of place. Lots of galleries, lots of artist studios there. But man, you can barely afford to live there. So you're like on the fifth floor of an old industrial building. It's a walk-up. It's a tiny, tiny little apartment, just a little Pullman kitchen there with like a sink and a two-burner cooktop. It's intense. There are so many people. You're in the middle of one of the biggest metropolises on the face of the globe. You walk out your door, you're anonymous. You're in this big sea of humanity out there. You wake up every morning, you don't hear birds singing. You hear the dumpster being unloaded in the alley below your apartment. You're walking up every day on this to the fifth floor. You're in this tiny little apartment. But man, you get out of that and you're by the High Line and you're in this really bohemian kind of artsy, cool district. If you live there for 10 years, it will shape who you are. You'd be a very, very different kind of person if you lived in the physical environment of Lockhart or if you lived in the physical environment of Chelsea in New York. Those communities have been built as a physical environment of a certain kind of culture or society. Lockhart came to be the way it is. The way the streets are laid out, the trees, the bungalows, the porches, where the churches are, where the school, all of this was a physical embodiment of a certain set of cultural values, who we are as a society. Likewise in Chelsea, that has developed as a very kind of 21st century attitude about how people live and how they interact and the relationship of arts and business and culture and intensity and experience. Architecture is a physical embodiment of who we are as society. It becomes an expression of those cultural values. Now, I love it when somebody important validates what I believe deeply in my soul. And in this case, we're going to be looking at Winston Churchill. I mean, who could get a better authority than Winston Churchill? He's like, the gold standard. So Winston Churchill, I mentioned last time, he actually was someone who was a very big fan of architecture, knew architecture very, very well. At the end of World War II, Winston Churchill is Prime Minister of England. And they have spent every dime they have on fighting this war. And they borrowed money, huge amounts of money, from the United States to finance the war. At the end of the war, that's what London looks like. It is devastated. It's been bombed like hell, you know, by the Germans, the Blitz. And it's just, you know, acres and acres and acres of the city are destroyed. Included in that destruction was they bombed Parliament houses, the sort of center of government. And so Winston Churchill is going before Parliament, and he's asking them to invest in the reconstruction of Parliament houses and, in a larger sense, of London. And they don't have any money, but he's asking them to spend money they don't have on reconstructing these buildings. And he's telling them how fundamental this is to the future of England. We have to do this. It's important for the future of England. And in that speech to Parliament, he says, "We shape our buildings. Thereafter, our buildings shape us. We shape our buildings. Thereafter, our buildings shape us." Now, that's a fundamental assumption we have in the class this semester, that this is a reciprocal thing. While we're designing buildings to accomplish certain goals, but then also they're very much shaping us. Now, if this is true, if architecture really is this important in society, why is it we don't talk about it more, we don't learn about it more, we're so abysmally ignorant about it in American culture? And actually, I'm not happy about that, but I kind of understand it. Because this effect is not conscious, it's more unconscious. It's more subliminal. So actually, there's a fantastic book, a recent book called Incognito. The author is David Eagleman. He's a neuroscientist. And he makes the argument that our experience of the world and the way our brain works is about 90% unconscious and 10% conscious. That most of what we do is unconscious. And he talks about the fact that if you actually get in your car and very intentionally think about, I'm making a right turn, how do I do that? I'm changing lanes, how do I do that? And that you're super conscious of doing it, you won't be able to drive the car. I mean, driving a car is an automatic thing. It's an unconscious thing. If you try to ride a bicycle and think, oh, I need to pedal this way and I need to hold my arms this way and I need to get balance by doing, you'll fall off the bike. The way our brain works is that it works unconsciously mostly. And I totally think this is the realm where architecture is powerful, in that 90% of the way our brain works, which is unconscious. Let me give you a few examples of that. So there is a researcher named Roger Ulrich, who is a social science researcher, and he's interested in health issues. And he posited that the physical environment of hospitals makes a difference in whether people recover or they don't recover. And so he looked at a hospital that had a double-loaded corridor. On each side of that corridor, identical hospital rooms. Everybody in those rooms are getting exactly the same kind of treatment from the same doctors and the same nurses. The only difference is that on one side of the corridor, the windows in the rooms look out 20 feet away to a blank brick wall. And they get very little light and they have no view. On the other side of the corridor, the identical windows look out to a beautiful garden with lots of big trees, children playing down there, a little fountain, a beautiful environment out there. Will there be a difference in the healing of the people on one side of the corridor with one light condition and one view condition, and on the other side of the corridor with a different light condition and view condition? So he looks at, over a long period of time, how do patients do in each of those rooms? And he measured two things in particular. One was, how often do they ask for pain medication? And the other one is, how long is their stay in the hospital for a similar malady? And over several years that he studied this hospital, he found that those patients that had the view of the garden were significantly less likely to ask for pain medication, and that their stay in the hospital was reduced significantly compared to the people across the hall. Now that is, were those patients in those rooms thinking, oh my God, I don't need any pain medication. I've got a beautiful view out my window. No, hell no. But unconsciously, the feeling they got from that view, the emotion they felt in relation to that view, made them need pain medication less than the poor people on the other side of the corridor that were in this depressing environment. Another kind of study. This one was a woman named Lisa Hishong. We'll actually read her book in the middle of the course. But Lisa Hishong in recent years has been doing studies for the school system in California, and then she also has done one for 12 states in the western and mountain regions. But looking at, does the physical environment of classrooms affect the learning that occurs within them, and particularly among elementary school children? And she's really just looking at the beginning, she was looking at just one parameter, and that was the amount of natural light that was in the classroom. So are kids learning different if they're in a classroom with no windows or some tiny little window, or in a classroom that has medium-sized windows, or in a classroom that has floor-to-ceiling glass and maybe even a skylight in addition to that? Will that make any difference in the way kids learn? And so she's looking at their test scores and improvement in test scores when they were operating in one kind of room versus another in terms of light. And she found, again, in a good social science study, that those students who were in the classrooms with more natural light performed better in both math and science, that they had higher improvements in their test scores from one year to the next in both math and reading when they were in classrooms that had more light. And in fact, the huge amount of light, floor-to-ceiling glass and skylights, had a big impact even over a modest-sized window. Now, that behavior actually has a kind of physiological basis because our bodies produce serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter, in direct relation to the amount of natural light we're exposed to. So, and actually, serotonin is much like Ritalin. A lot of times when kids have ADD or they can't pay attention, it's because they're not getting enough neurotransmitters. So you can give them Ritalin or you can increase their serotonin production. So all these kids that are getting tons and tons of natural light, it's pumping up their serotonin production. They've got better neurotransmitters. They're able to pay attention more and they're able to think and learn better. The physical environment is having a big impact on their performance as a student. Now, again, are these teachers thinking, I am not teaching in that damn classroom with no windows because my kids will not be producing serotonin and they will not be paying attention and I will not be able to teach them as well? We're not conscious of it at that level. But does that mean it doesn't operate? No. In fact, it operates at this unconscious level. These kids are having that, the effect is happening on them, whether they're conscious of it or not. In all of these cases, we shape our buildings. Thereafter, our buildings shape us. So let me give you a personal anecdote here that I've used 1,000 times, and it just describes exactly the situation we're in. So when I have this guy who is like my best friend for life. He's always been my best friend. He's still my best friend. And we grew up together and went to school all the way through elementary school, high school. We went to different undergraduate schools, but then we both went to graduate school in Boston. He went to law school at Harvard. I went to architecture school at MIT. So we found ourselves back together again, lived two blocks apart from each other, and could, you know, reaffirm our friendship when we were in graduate school. So we were totally, totally tight. Then he decided to move to Washington, D.C. He's a lawyer. He's a political junkie. You know, Washington was like heaven for him. So he moves down to D.C., gets a job with a really good law firm, just exactly what he wanted out of law school. I stayed in Boston, taught at MIT for several years. So he's living in Washington. I'm living in Boston. So this is way, way before email or anything like that. This kind of communication is like, you know, once a week you talk on the telephone. So he's calling me on the phone periodically. And he said, you know, Larry, I totally don't get it, but I'm depressed. I mean, the job is exactly what I anticipated. I love Washington. It's just what I wanted. But I'm depressed. I can hardly get out of bed in the morning. I just have no motivation. And this isn't like me. I've never been like this. Of course you haven't. I mean, this is weird. But he keeps saying that. So I don't know. He's been there a couple of months. And I said, look, let me drive down from Boston and we'll spend a weekend together and see if I can cheer you up. So I drive down there, go to his law firm, pick up the key so I can go back to his place. Go back to the place. Oh, my God, he lives in this really, really bad neighborhood. I mean, sketchy neighborhood. And he lives on the third floor of this kind of townhouse, row house building. So you walk in the door, the whole stairwell smells like pee. You walk up the stair, open up his apartment. So the landlord had totally painted the entire apartment before he moved in. But the way he painted it was they spray painted everything beige. Walls, ceilings, everything. The kitchen cabinet spray painted beige, all the hardware spray painted beige. The doors spray painted beige, all the hardware spray painted beige. The door handle spray painted beige. I mean, they didn't mask anything, didn't they? They just spray painted everything beige. He just had his mattress like on the floor because he hadn't got a bed stand for it. All his books were like in boxes, everything sitting around in boxes in his apartment. So I sit around in there for a while and, you know, he comes in later and I said, look, it's no mystery why you're depressed. You live in a really depressing place, depressing neighborhood, depressing apartment. Everything's depressing here. I'd be depressed if I lived here. You got to get out of this. And he said, oh, Larry, that's just, you're just an architect. You think that's so damn important. It's not a big deal for me. Look, I don't even spend any time here. I'm at work all the time. I just come here to crash. I don't know what it is making me depressed, but that's not it. So we spend the weekend together. I go back to Boston. I keep hearing him whining every week on the phone. I'm so depressed, you know. And so finally I said, look, you have got to get out of that place. He had a 6-month lease on it, said, I'm coming down. We're going to find you a new place. So we looked around. We found this really, really cool apartment. One thing is he still thought of himself as this poor college student, like I can't afford anything else. He's a freaking rich lawyer, you know. He's making lots of money. So I said, spend some of it, dude. So we get in a nicer neighborhood and find a sort of row house, but this place is on the ground floor. So it has like living room, dining room, kitchen on the ground floor. And then it spills out in the back to a little patio with a big tree there and brick paving on the patio. And, you know, really, really cool patio space and big glass door that opens up to the patio. And we went out and bought him some furniture. He didn't have anything. Bought him a really expensive leather chaise. I thought he was going to pee in his pants when he put the credit card for that thing. It was just so expensive, he couldn't imagine spending that much money. He still has that leather chaise all these years later. He still has it. That was a wonderful investment. It was great. Bought him this leather chaise, some other pieces of furniture, put some pictures on the wall, bought some plants. you know, fix the place up. And so then, you know, I went back up to Boston. So I don't know, maybe a month later, he calls me on a Sunday evening. And he said, Larry, I had the coolest day today. So, you know, a couple of blocks from my house, there's that little public tennis court there. Well, I invited a couple of guys from work, and we played doubles tennis all morning out on this tennis court in my neighborhood. And then you remember there was this little bakery just down the block from me. Well, I went to the bakery, and we got some croissants and some orange juice. And then we came back to my place, and we sat out on that back patio under the big tree there. And it was a gorgeous day. The sun was shining. We got out the Washington Post, and we read the newspaper, and we, you know, had our croissants and our orange juice. And then in the afternoon, we went back inside the apartment, and we watched the Redskins game, and Redskins won, and it was really great. And, you know, I'm feeling better. Things are good, you know? Things are good. And I said, you freaking idiot! Don't you understand that if you put yourself in a physical environment that is depressing and that does not support a good, rich, vital life, you will live a miserable existence. And if you do put yourself in a position where you can do things, make friends, have activities that enrich you, and in a place that is pleasant and supportive, you'll have a better life. And you know, he learned that lesson. He learned that lesson extraordinarily well. He lives in a beautiful house in Washington, D.C. He stayed there all these years. He's actually lived in 3 different houses. He's always used a really good architect to help him, you know, make just the right environment for him and for his family. And he's had a great life. But all of this is unconscious. And that's maybe why we don't understand it so well, because it's unconscious. This guy is a smart guy, but then in a certain way, he's a stupid asshole because he couldn't understand what was really going on, really even with himself in relation to the physical environment. So we're assuming that architecture is a physical embodiment of who we are as individuals and who we are collectively as a society. And did we just lose the PowerPoint? I'm assuming it'll come back in a minute. So I want to make an argument here that architecture is in fact kind of pervasive in many different aspects of culture and of society. So let's take just for a minute the example of literature. So we could think of, oh, well, literature, that's very different from architecture. They're not really related, but bullshit, that's absolutely not true. I would make the argument that pretty much any great author uses architecture as a means of supporting their literature. And that's absolutely true of people like Charles Dickens or Victor Hugo or any of the sort of classic writers, but it's also very true of more contemporary writers as well. So for years in this class, to make this point, I used the example of Great Expectations by Charles Dickens and made the argument that he's telling you the story by putting you in physical places vicariously. He's describing a place. He's using your imagination to put you in that place, and then you had certain feelings from that that then would transfer to the characters that were in that place. And he was letting you know about these characters by letting you experience the physical environment that they were in. So I used that example for many years. And finally, one of the students in the class emailed me, and I think he bested me. He got a better example. So I'm going to read you this that this student emailed me. So after this lecture, he said that J.K. Rowling in Harry Potter books uses architecture to characterize the individuals within those books. Harry, for example, lives the first 10 years of his life in a broom closet and has to scrunch up his feet in order to sleep at night. The rest of his aunt and uncle's house where he lives is uncomfortably sterile. The reader automatically feels sympathy for Harry. His best friend Ron Weasley's house is the complete opposite. Delightfully homey, a bungalow-looking three-story-high rickety old house that is much lived in. The kitchen is constantly in a flurry of activity. There are garden gnomes running amok in the garden. The reader identifies with this and wants this rough love atmosphere that the home presents. Then at Hogwarts, the school itself, it's enormous and intimidating from the outside, though inside very homey. The portraits on the wall each have their own personality and will talk to the students. There are trick staircases and a multitude of shortcuts. The dorms have low light, high ceilings, and squashy armchairs. The ceiling of the great dining hall is bewitched to match the sky outside. In short, this school is a paradise, offering both great protection, but not at the mercy of personalization. Now, I couldn't have said that better. In literature, often, great authors use that unconscious experience of the physical environment to communicate to us feelings they want us to have. And they use it to describe characters like the Weasley family. We know what that family's like because J.K. Rowling tells us about the place they live. And we feel it. We feel it deeply, more than them saying, if J.K. Rowling had said, these people love each other, they really have a cool relationship with each other, they're always sort of relaxed and they shouldn't have to say that. She just tells us about the place they live. And we can feel that in the literature. So I'm saying that architecture is a subtext of great literature. I would also ask you to think about architecture as a subtext of film. And I'm going to talk about three classic films here. And just think of how the physical environment is so important in the storytelling of a film. So let's look at The Wizard of Oz to begin with. So, okay, we start with Dorothy in Kansas, and the film is in black and white. And it is dull, and it is routine, and it is stupid, and she's bored, and you know something about Dorothy from her life in Kansas. And then the tornado strikes, and everything's topsy-turvy, and she lights down in Munchkin Land. And Munchkin Land, it suddenly turns to Technicolor, and now everything's bright red and yellow, blue and green, and they're little, tiny people singing, "We want to welcome you to Munchkin Land." And, it's a totally different environment. So what has that change of environment? There's no dialogue in that part of the film. What did the change of environment do to our head? Suddenly we see, totally different Dorothy here and a totally different kind of emotion and experience that goes with it. The filmmaker is talking to us in architecture and letting us experience the power of the film by changing the physical environment. So then, Dorothy starts out on the yellow brick road and she's trying to find the Wizard of Oz. And as she goes along her path, she encounters three different individuals that will be on this trek with her. And each of the individuals is totally characterized by a physical environment where she finds them. So we start out where it's a bright sunny day, we're on the yellow brick road, we're going through the cornfield, everything's bright and cheery. And we run into the Scarecrow. And who is the Scarecrow? He's this bright, cheery guy who hasn't got a brain. Not a worry in the world, hasn't got a brain, everything's cool. And the physical environment we find him in just tells us about this Scarecrow who hasn't got a brain. Then we go down the yellow brick road more and more, and it begins to get twisty and windy, and we begin to go into a forest, and it's dark, and we can't see where we're going, and it's a little creepy, and there's moss on the trees, it's a little scary, And that's where we find the cowardly lion. The physical environment prepares us for who the cowardly lion is. He's scared. He's nervous. He's unprepared. He's, you know, and that's the kind of environment we're in, where we don't know what's going to be around the corner. And it feels, you know, a little scary. And that's where we pick up the cowardly lion. And we get the tin man, and then we go down the Illerbrook Road, and the slide on the left here, they emerge from the forest, and they look to Oz, and Dorothy turns to the other three, and she says, "Whoa, this must be a great and powerful wizard to live in a place like that." How does she know he's a powerful wizard? He lives in a place like that. It's the architecture that's telling her who this wizard is. It's the architecture that's telling us what to anticipate with this wizard. So then they go into the wizard's castle, and they, you know, see the horse of a different color, and they walk through these corridors, and finally they get to the presence of the wizard in the slide on the right. And it's this mammoth room, and it's made of, you know, gigantic, large-scale columns, and the acoustics are extremely reverberant, and we hear this big voice of God. What is the wizard? The wizard is architecture. It's a big, badass room with a little guy behind a curtain, you know, sort of orchestrating the room. But it is that the power of the wizard is this architectural environment that's been set up for him. Now, all the way through that movie, the filmmaker is using the physical environment to deal with our emotions, to make us feel things, to make us understand who the characters are, to tell the story that he's telling in the film. Completely different movie, another classic. This is Gone with the Wind. And on the left-hand side here, we have Scarlett O'Hara at age 18 in her home at Tara. At the beginning, they're having a party at the house. And, you know, just look at that room. Look at that room. What do you know about Scarlett from that room? She lives in a very affluent family, in a really lovely, lovely home. They're erudite. They've got this wonderful library. She's sitting there talking to Ashley Wilkes. Her life is pleasant and wonderful and sweet and beautiful. And that's who Scarlett is at age 18. But it's the physical environment that's telling us the story in that film. Another classic, the early Star Wars movies. And I could easily say this about the current Star Wars movie, too. But in the slide on, this is in The Empire Strikes Back, the third of the original trilogy. And the slide on the left, Luke Skywalker has gone to get the power of the Force. He's going to visit the Jedi Master, Yoda, and he's going to get the power of the Force. And he's on his, you know, gullwing plane headed out there, and he's anticipating, man, this is going to be one badass dude, this, you know, Jedi warrior, Yoda. And then he crashes his plane, and he's in Dagobah. And it's swampy, and it's nasty. And it's dark and kind of creepy feeling, and there is nothing powerful or authoritative about this environment. And Yoda is this creepy little gnome squirt with big ears, you know, this is not what he expected. But what George Lucas is telling us is he's telling us what the power of the Force is. This is not big time, might makes right kind of. This is another kind of power, an inner power, a softer power, a more power, but not one that's about pretension or authority. Now, that physical environment tells us about the power of the Force in a certain way. Then on the right-hand side, the Death Star, this is Darth Vader's house. And it is a man, cold, hard, super pretentious and authoritative kind of force. This is another kind of power. And those two kinds of power are clashing against each other. And how does George tell us about those kinds of power? He shows us two different physical environments. And he makes us feel in our gut the difference between the power of the force one way and the power of the force in another way. I'm telling you that film has a huge subtext of architecture in it. And what we often call special effects in film, really just architecture. They're these amazing physical environments that new technology has allowed filmmakers to imagine and to portray and to put us in those environments and make us feel something the filmmaker wants us to feel. I would say it's also a subtext. Architecture is a subtext of music often. Now, plenty of people, music, are you kidding me? That doesn't have anything to do with architecture. No. You know, this room itself, actually, is we share it between architecture and music. It is primarily a concert hall for performance. And the room has everything to do with supporting the acoustics of the music. And performances in this room are greatly affected, certainly by the acoustics. If you're a vocalist singing in this room, the acoustics make a huge difference in the way people hear your voice. But also the feeling, the tenor, the scale, it affects performance enormously. So there isn't that immediate space that a performance is done in. There's an impact of the music. But in this case, in these slides, we're looking at a whole genre of music that came out of New Orleans, and in particular out of the French Quarter, Dixieland jazz. And if you go to the French Quarter and you just sense the rhythms of that community, the almost even the climate, the fan, one of those bars going wakata, 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 the porches, just the ambiance and the feeling of the neighborhood is so like Dixieland jazz. It's just the same damn thing. And you cannot imagine Dixieland jazz coming out of Des Moines, Iowa. It just wouldn't happen. There was something in the rhythm and the character of that community and that neighborhood that generated a kind of musical expression in Dixieland jazz. Astute politicians understand that architecture can be a subtext of politics. There was an incredibly powerful pope in Rome, Sixtus V. He had a huge impact on the city of Rome. So he, as a young boy, had been a messenger in the Catholic Church. He would carry messages between the various churches and between the various church officials in Rome. And he got to know the city extremely well. At that point, the city would have been this maze of twisty, windy medieval streets. When he got to be pope, he was super ambitious for the church. He decided, I am going to make Rome the holy city. Everyone's going to think of Rome as the home of the church and the holy city. The whole city is about this religion. And he transformed the city by cutting these long, straight streets through the twisty, windy fabric of the city. And it, Santa Maria Maggiore, this big church, existed right there. St. Peter's, this big church that was a building out here. The churches at Piazza del Popolo, San Lorenzo, St. Paul's outside the walls. All of these churches that were there, but because everything around it was kind of invisible. So he cut these long straight streets through so that when you walked out on a major street, you looked down this way and saw Santa Maria Maggiore. You looked down this way and you saw St. Peter's. You went to another street and you looked down this way and saw the churches at Piazza del Popolo. Always, 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 the church is in the middle, in the frame of the city. And he transformed Rome into the holy city. And it, to this day, we think of it. A couple of hundred years later, we find the same thing happening in France. Louis XIV decided, I am going to make my monarchy the most powerful monarchy in Europe. I am going to kick butt with all those other kings and queens in Europe. And the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to build the coolest palace, the most amazing palace anyone's ever seen. And then I'm going to invite all the crowned heads of Europe to my palace, and it's going to demonstrate to them how I am much more sophisticated, I am much more erudite, I am much more powerful than they are. So he built the palace at Versailles, outside of Paris. He, in fact, built the whole town of Versailles to focus on the palace right there. And then he built huge gardens to reinforce that palace. And he created a whole ensemble of experience that was more majestic and more elegant and more sophisticated than anything that existed in Europe at the time. And then he invited all of those other kings and queens to visit him. And they said, holy shit, this guy, whoa, that's amazing. And they all went to Leningrad, to Berlin, or to Vienna, and they tried to copy him. And he became the most prominent monarch in Europe. He used architecture as a vehicle for accomplishing his political goals. All right, I'm going to take a little pause here. And I want to I want to have a chat with you. So I'm looking for a volunteer to have a little chat with me. Someone along this line. Okay. Stand up. So what is your name?
Miguel.
What year? Major year?
Yeah. Electrical engineering.
Electrical engineering.
I want to know if there's any intersection between architecture and electrical engineering. Maybe we even say engineering in a larger sense. Do you see architecture as any kind of subtext for electrical engineering?
Yeah. For electrical engineering specifically, there's embedded systems where you design a chip and make it the most. And to do that, you have to figure out where the pathways are going to be in a chip. And for normal architecture, I'm not really sure about chemical, but for petroleum engineering, some. And for, I forgot the architectural engineering, I guess, also.
So actually, there's something, and we do talk about the architecture of a software program sometimes. We all talk about the architecture of a chip design. So that. And actually, in a lot of computer language, we talk about rooms or realms, windows. Wait, how did all that happen? Why are there all these architectural references in the computer world? In part because when the whole computer revolution began, people started thinking of how do we store information? And because our minds think spatially, how we store information, we began to organize the computer in the way that the physical environment is organized. So I think there is very much a subtext of our experience of space and architecture and how those things get organized in the city or in the physical environment, and then how we began to organize data and information in a computer sense. That's cool, right? So somebody else. Got another volunteer? How about on the other side? Somebody want to just have a chat. Maybe you see some connection between what you're interested in. It may not even be your major, but something you're interested in. Is there a subtext of architecture in that? Okay, where are you? Raise your hand. Okay. So stand up. Let's have a chat. What's your name?
Ryan.
What year?
I'm a fifth-year senior.
Senior.
What's your major? Finance and computer science.
Okay. So do you see some intersection between architecture and finance?
I was actually hoping you would point that out.
Okay. So let me point that out. You know, we don't think about this very much, but one enormous part of the whole financial scene is the financing of buildings. You know, the whole mortgage crisis we just got through, you know, and horrible, horrible thing, that was all financing real estate. It was financing the construction of buildings. So the entire financial structure of the United States is very heavily dependent on the finance of real estate, and that really is making architecture.
Structure, how you structure a deal could be considered a form of architecture?
Absolutely. But certainly, if you're financing a project, one of the things you're going to really be looking at is it going to be successful? Is it going to work as architecture? Is it going to serve people or not serve people? If it's not, they're not going to buy those condos. They're not going to live in that place. And the whole financing of it is screwed. So, yeah, I mean, the whole financial structure in the United States and right now in China, one of the things that's really getting screwed up in China right now is because their financial structure has really been built on construction and real estate. And now slowing that down, you know, how do they make money anymore? How do they really fuel their financial engine? So I mean, no matter what somebody came up with as their major or their discipline of interest, architecture is embedded in a subtext of so much that we do in society. Now, I want to, for the rest of the class, talk about how we see this societal values and character embedded in architecture. We're going to look at two houses in Texas, and then we're going to look at a few public buildings, kind of iconic buildings. So the first of these houses in Texas is a house called the Bishop's Palace. The architect was Nicholas John Clayton. It was done between 1886 and 1891. This one is open to the public. You can go tour the Bishop's Palace in Galveston. Anybody been to the Bishop's Palace? Okay, a few. If you're going to the beach in Galveston, shit, take an hour or so. It's on Broadway, near the beach. Just go by and take a look at this house. Now, to understand this house, we have to think of the culture that it was built in. And actually, going to it and experiencing it helps us understand the culture it was a part of. Galveston, at the turn of the 19th and 20th century, was the largest city in Texas, by far. It was a super cosmopolitan city. It was a port, and people came from all over the world and exchanged goods there. And it was a thriving, vital city. The big storm came in 1900, and that really stymied Galveston for the rest of its existence. But up until 1900, this was the place to be in Texas. This guy who built this house, a guy named Gresham, was a merchant, and he traveled all over the world and sold goods. He was very, very successful. He was rich. And he would go around the world. He would find things he liked, send them back to his architect. So he would find a fireplace, or he would find a brake front, or he would find a balustrade, and he would just have it dismantled in Sweden or wherever it was, and have it shipped back to Nicholas Clayton, and said, you know, find a way to incorporate this house. So just like Galveston was this eclectic collection of people from all over the world, so the building became an eclectic collection of artifacts from all over the world. And it became this cosmopolitan amalgamation. And that's really what Galveston was become, this cosmopolitan amalgamation. At the same time, also all about saying, man, we're positive, we're optimistic, we're successful, we're going somewhere. That was absolutely the spirit of Galveston at the time. We're establishing this new place, this new part of the country. Texas was nothing at this point. And there was no oil. There was no big cattle business. This was the beginning of Texas. And these guys had ambition. And the house just reeks of that ambition, that headstrong, positive, optimistic look on how life could be. This eclectic combination of people and things that come together and become this new, exciting culture. It also said, laying down roots here. There were no big cities in Texas. We're building the first one. We're going to make it permanent, solid rock. We're there. It's built to last. And in fact, this was one of the few structures in Galveston that withstood the hurricane of 1900, virtually unharmed. It was built like, man, we're here to stay. This is going to be the new promising future of the world. There also is this interesting kind of sweetness in the building. You get a sense of the Gresham family themselves. These little griffins that he found somewhere and had sent back and incorporated into the building. They're beautiful little light fixtures and this beautifully painted porcelain sink. Mrs. Gresham was an artist herself, and she painted portraits of all of her children on the walls and on the ceilings in different parts of the house. I don't know, 8 or 10 kids, and she did all these portraits. There is this warmth and gentility and sweetness right alongside this powerful, strong business cosmopolitan house. It's just a way in which you can experience that house, and you can feel some fundamental things about what Galveston was, what that culture was, and what these people were at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. Now, in stark contrast, this is another house built in Texas in another era. This is what's often called the Foam House. It was built here in Austin. In 1969, the architect was Charles Harker. Again, you got to think of what is the culture that's evident here. So this was the late 60s. There was a lot of rebellion going on. This is hippie generation. Austin was the hotbed of rebellion in Texas. It was the place everybody went to hang out, cool, and smoke dope, have a crazy lifestyle. And the city was being known for that. And this is a rebellion that was saying, this was my generation of college students. Damn, it was just a matter. We actually thought, culture as we know it is going to go away. Everything's going to change. There's going to be a rebellion, and everything's going to change. So it was a time of looking at alternative lifestyles. Why would you live in families? You ought to live in communes. Alternative moral codes, sex, drugs, rock and roll. Alternative dress. You wore your hair really long. Your parents got super upset. Kind of dirty, ragged. That was fine. Whereas your parents were all these, tie and coat. Anyway, this complete transformation and complete rebellion. And on another level, this house says, so what the heck? What's this 3-bedroom, 2-bath, 2-car garage shit? That's not, we got to rethink houses. And what is this brick or stone or roof or walls or, just rethink everything. Just start from scratch. What is a house? And it's really about space, and it's about light, and it's about being organic, fitting into the landscape and the natural terrain. And why would we make it out of those old conventional mirror materials like wood and brick and stone? We're going to make it out of new stuff. So this is out of polyurethane foam, and you made an armature out of metal, and then you sprayed on the foam, and you can make these great organic shapes. And this is actually for a guy who was a lawyer, and he was like, man, the world's going to be new and fresh and different, and this is going to be an alternative way of thinking about a house, a way to live. And it was done at great expense and interesting and sophisticated way. And it was completed in 1969. It was done by a bunch of hippies who were, learning new craft and learning new building techniques all the time. And then, interestingly enough, it self-destructed within 10 years. One thing they didn't have completely together was the fact that polyurethane foam actually is very sensitive to ultraviolet light, and it deteriorates in sunlight. So the minute it was finished, it started destroying itself. But besides that, it also was right in the middle of what is now very valuable commercial property in Westlake Hills, and within a very short period of time, they wanted to put a shopping center there and, sell Apple devices. So the whole real estate thing changed. And just like that hippie movement that was a little ephemeral, and those same guys with long hair and dreadlocks and, you know, a hippie dog with a kerchief around his neck and, you know, all that, and sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Those same people went to law school and became, you know, your lawyer. And so things, that whole hippie movement just evaporated, just like the house kind of evaporated. But this ephemeral, momentary rebellion is so beautifully captured in that house. That house is what that culture was. It's a physical embodiment of a society at that time. Now, if we look at great iconic buildings in architecture, we could look at the Parthenon in Athens. I could treat it as a famous artifact to just learn that building, and that's what architecture is about. To me, that's just, that is total bullshit. The thing that makes the Parthenon interesting is the culture it came out of. Now, in Athens, in way back, 447 to 430 BC, 100 years before Christ, in 480 BC, the Persians ruled the world. They had an empire. The Persians came in, and they sacked Athens, and they burned the Acropolis, and they took over. And the Persians were the new empire. But then, shortly after that, Pericles came in and he kicked their ass and threw them out of Athens and reestablished the Greek Empire. And shortly after the reestablishment of the Greek Empire, Pericles said, we're going to rebuild the Acropolis. So this is a mature culture that had already ruled the world, and they are now building the iconic moment that expresses what is Greek culture. And it's a whole ensemble of buildings that were built pretty much at the same time to say what this powerful culture was at the time. Now, there are a lot of things they were great at in Greece. Number one, these were the guys who invented a lot of our mathematics and science and technology. And they had discoveries of the Pythagorean theorem and a lot of math and science. And you can see that in the building. This simple rectangular object, this love of precision, this understanding of straight lines and perfect circles and elegant, exact geometry. It's built into the building. They also were a culture that was all about public spaces. They weren't so much about their homes. They were about a collective society. And you get the sense of this huge investment in this public forum for all of them to meet and to have discussions and to had this sense of democracy that was emerging there, of people ruling themselves. They also were really strong in the arts, in theater in particular. They kind of invented, and you can get the dramatic quality, the kind of awe and scale and emotion in the buildings on the Acropolis as well. And then in the detail, in the sculpture, the bas-reliefs that were a part of the complex. And there are stories, very specific stories, about the gods they believed in, about the battle between the centaurs, these godlike creatures, and the ordinary Greek human beings. There are things about their everyday life, about being merchants, about their stock, about exchanging goods in the marketplaces. They're really telling the story of what this culture is about in the specific iconography of the Parthenon. It is a physical embodiment of that culture. And in being that, that's what makes it interesting to me as a piece of architecture, and that's what's made it an iconic piece of architecture through the ages. A different kind of iconic architecture, St. Peter's in Rome, it expresses also this incredible confluence of money and religion and political power in the papacy, in the Renaissance, in Rome. It started in the 15th century in Florence. It moved to Rome in the 16th century. And these incredibly powerful popes built over a series of years this growing building. It was done by all these different architects. So every generation of pope would try to do the guy before. And it's trying to express the primacy of religion, but oddly enough, religion expressed through money and political power. And this place is awesome. It is so incredibly huge. It just, you get the sense of God being there and of this incredible concentration of power, money, and wealth, and riches, and opulence, and expression of all that. These also were very corrupt popes. It wasn't like they were pure as the driven snow. And there's this kind of warring competition among them to outdo with every new phase of the building. But again, it's an expression of that culture, those people, religion and politics and money all coming together into this incredible infusion of a place. So I've got a Twitter card question for you today. So get out your 3x5 card. You'll have a few minutes to do it here. And I want you to think of a building or a place somewhere that you think expresses an individual or a culture you've been a part of. Okay, listen up here. If you don't have a 3x5 card, today we'll accept a little scrap of paper from your notebook. But 3x5 card is good, and it's just indicative. Next time, have a freaking 3x5 card. Okay, this is the question. I want you to think of, maybe it's in your hometown. Maybe it's someplace you visited on vacation. Maybe it's, your grandparents' farmhouse. I don't care where it is. Think of a place that expresses to you an individual or a culture. Just in a sentence or two, tell me how it expresses that. How all these things we've been talking about today, how does this apply to some place you've experienced or you know? How does a physical environment become an embodiment of individuals or a culture?